This is Ron Stockton. I want to offer you an update on the Israel-Gaza war. Today is November 1st. Israel is pounding Gaza in what looks like the early stages of an invasion. I suspect their soldiers are very nervous about entering Gaza because of the dangers of urban warfare. And I'm also nervous about preparing a podcast that could well be outdated by the time you listen to it. For example, just yesterday, Israel bombed the Jabalia refugee camp. They said they were targeting the home of a key Hamas leader. They say their attack was successful. But the images show a vast crater that had been blown away. I've been to Jabalia camp. The people are stacked in like sardines. That bomb almost certainly destroyed many houses. Local hospital authorities, not Hamas, say that at least 50 people were killed. I suspect the number will rise. What will be the consequence of this? Nothing, I suspect, except perhaps the surviving sons of those neighboring families will pledge themselves to avenge their relatives. If you have not listened to my earlier podcast, you might find it useful. It focuses upon the events of October 7th, the historical context, and some early analysis. At this point, there is little to say about the combat because we don't know very much. But there is quite a bit we can say about politics and data. First, let me make a point I should have made in the first podcast but did not. On October 7th, there were three different attacks. In the shock of the day, they looked the same, but they were quite different. First, there was the attack on the music festival. That was the bloodiest. It started with a missile strike at 6 a.m., but was quickly followed with ground attack that killed large numbers of people. As I said before, it chills the blood. If you want to use the word terrorism, which I try to avoid because of its inflammatory misuse, this would be an appropriate case. The second attack was on several military positions. Some were overrun. In some cases, the Israeli defenders fled. One target was a communications center. Hamas cut off the contact between the various units, so the IDF was fighting blind. This was a conventional military attack. That would not be considered terrorism. The third attack was upon the Jewish towns that surrounded Gaza. One was Sderot, which I visited once. It is just 2,700 feet from Gaza. It is frequently shelled. When I was there, it experienced what Israelis called a red voice, i.e. a warning siren. Fortunately, the rockets fired towards us fell into the empty space between Gaza and Sderot. According to news reports from October 7th, several residents were killed and Sderot was evacuated, at least temporarily. Sderot itself has a population of 20,000. Many are Arab Jews, that is, people originally from North Africa or other Arab lands. At this point, Israel has mobilized 350,000 reservists. Israel has an enormous army, but on any given day, few are in uniform. In an emergency, they can be called up. But 350,000 reservists in uniform constitutes an important component of the civilian workforce. With its technological superiority, Israel has an advantage in a war of quick decision. They are at a disadvantage in a protracted war. This looks as if this war will not be over quickly. And they have 100,000 Israeli soldiers on the Gaza border. They must be terrified at the thought of going house to house in urban guerrilla warfare. 49% of all Israelis want a delay in the invasion so there can be an emphasis on getting the hostages out. Hamas has offered an exchange, all of our prisoners for all of your prisoners. There's little likelihood that Israel would agree to that, but they have said they are not going to speak publicly about secret discussions. Something is happening in Qatar, but nobody knows what. If Hamas agreed to release their hostages, but knew there would be a massive bombardment the next day, that would not be a smart move. Across the world, popular support for a ceasefire is enormous. Massive demonstrations have taken place. Just last Sunday, October 29th, there was an enormous demonstration in London covering Westminster Bridge and stretching into the city. Of course, there are demonstrations across the Arab and Islamic world, but also across the rest of the world. The governments of the NATO powers appear to be fully behind Israel, but their voters are not in the same place. And of course, NATO is not the world. To much of the world, this is a case of Israel keeping the Palestinians in a wretched state and then crying for help and vengeance when they strike back. There have even been demonstrations in the U.S. and elsewhere by Jews calling for a ceasefire. Hundreds of protesters, mostly Jews, chanting "Let Gaza live," took over Grand Central Station. 200 were arrested. At the very same time, the organized Jewish community has mobilized to support Israel. American politicians have almost to a person lined up behind Israel. Joe Biden and our Michigan governor, Gretchen Whitmer, have made statements so pro-Israeli that they have grievously alienated their former allies. There is a factor in the public reaction to this war that you need to consider. It is the images coming out of Gaza. They are horrifying and terrible and ubiquitous. Sometimes an interview with an Israeli official is in a split screen with those images. Those of us who follow this conflict closely are familiar with these types of images, but most people have never encountered such things before. They have been taught to dehumanize the Palestinians. They are terrorists. They are extremists. They want to destroy Israel. But now we're seeing images of people obviously not Hamas fighters. Terrified mothers or fathers, small children clinging to their parents, or to a younger sibling with no parent in sight. We are seeing waves of refugees fleeing from northern Gaza to southern Gaza, where supposedly they will be safe. We are seeing lines of shrouded bodies waiting for burial. Lines of them, often small bodies. And we are seeing images of destroyed neighborhoods. Those of us who remember the Vietnam War will remember the impact that photos had on us. A naked little girl running and screaming as napalm burned her body. A prisoner with a gun pointed at his temple at the very moment of his death. A ditch filled with bodies. A bombardment destroying a whole mountainside. We were shocked at those images, horrified. It was the first living room war, as people said at the time. It had a major impact on American thinking. And the images coming out of Gaza are going to have a major impact on American opinion and on world opinion. And if you think we're getting a powerful dose of those images, just imagine what the rest of the world is seeing, where the television news is not headlined, "Israel at War." The U.S. has made emergency plans to evacuate American citizens from Israel and Lebanon should it be necessary. There are approximately 600,000 American citizens in Israel and 86,000 in Lebanon. There are also 400 American citizens and their families in Gaza, perhaps 1,000 people in total. And there are 45,000 to 60,000 American Palestinians on the West Bank. I'm guessing that most are dual passport citizens of Israel and Lebanon, perhaps people who immigrated or returned to their homeland but kept their American passports. Some could be visiting family, but those are being urged to evacuate ASAP. We had a similar situation in 2006 when the Israeli-Lebanon war occurred during school vacation. Hundreds of students from Dearborn schools were in Lebanon visiting grandparents and other family. Those had to be evacuated quickly. The U.S. arranged for them to be moved onto ships in the Mediterranean. I suspect something similar would happen if this situation goes south. Biden has said, "When they release the hostages, we'll talk." I seriously doubt that he means that. I think negotiating with Hamas might produce some positive outcomes, but it will not happen, at least not for the time being, and at least not until the Israelis have had their moment. The Israeli line on this is that you cannot negotiate with someone who wants to kill you. If I were an Israeli, I might say the same thing. Of course, Henry Kissinger negotiated with the North Vietnamese even as they killed Americans. And when Arafat was accused of negotiating with the Israelis, even as they continued to kill Palestinians, he said, "Of course I negotiate with my enemies. With my friends, I make business deals." But that does not seem to be the mindset of the day. Netanyahu says that this is our second war of independence. Most Israelis believe Hamas wants to destroy Israel. Their leaders keep talking about the Holocaust and the Nazis as parallels to what is happening today. I always told my students to avoid references to that period of history when discussing the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Don't say that the Palestinians want to complete what Hitler started, or that the Israelis are doing to the Palestinians what the Nazis did to the Jews. This just damages our ability to analyze or to think. Of course, if you just want to inflame the discourse, then use those words to your heart's content. I saw an interview with the leader of the Anti-Defamation League. He was asked about the danger to both Jews and Muslims in the U.S. and whether they had been trying to work together. He said that there had been 400 demonstrations that embraced the attacks of October 7th, and it is impossible to work with such people. As of today, there have been verbal attacks and threats directed at Jews, but thank God no fatalities that I know of. There was one disturbing internet threat by a student at Cornell University. He is now in police custody. Interestingly, he appears to be Asian American. The only assault I know of was on a 6-year-old Palestinian boy in Chicago who was stabbed to death by his landlord. His mother was also stabbed but will survive. The assailant was not a Jew, but was very pro-Israeli. He was shouting pro-Israeli and anti-Muslim statements and told his victims to go back to where they came from. And we do have to mention that former President Trump, the probable Republican nominee in 2024, has promised to ban and expel anyone expressing support for Hamas. I am afraid for both Muslims and Jews. I think there is a greater danger than has ever occurred within my lifetime, maybe even in American history. I read an essay by an Egyptian writer published in a London newspaper. He said Hamas made the same mistake Al-Qaeda had made. They took an unachievable goal to destroy a whole society. Well, that was not the logic of Osama bin Laden. Osama was renounced almost universally for deciding to attack the far enemy, as he said. Other Islamist groups were fighting against their local governments in Syria, Egypt, Algeria, Yemen, etc. Osama decided that the real problem was that those governments were being propped up by the Americans. Unless the Americans were struck, the problem would never be addressed. He decided to strike against the far enemy. Hamas is like Hezbollah. It is a resistance movement trying to end an occupation. Its name means Islamic Resistance Movement. It has never taken its battle to other countries, and certainly not to the U.S. When Netanyahu says that Israel is fighting for the survival of the United States, it is just predictable Netanyahu rhetoric. Some numbers from October 7th might be useful. Of the 220 or so hostages, 138 have foreign passports from 25 different countries. 15 are Argentinians, 12 Germans, 12 Americans, 6 French, 6 Russian. There are also 24 from Thailand, 5 from Nepal, 1 from Sri Lanka, 2 from Tanzania, 2 from the Philippines. Many of these non-Western persons were workers rather than participants in the music event. Regarding those killed on October 7th, Americans had 34 dead and 5 missing. Ukraine had 25 dead and 2 missing. France had 23 dead and 7 missing. Russia had 23 dead and 4 missing. China had 5 dead and 1 missing. Nepal had 5 dead and 5 missing. The IDF reported that 309 military had died that day. Haaretz was able to identify 683 Israelis killed on October 7th. 331 were soldiers or police. 13 were rescue service personnel. These numbers are for about half of the Israeli total. There were no children under 3 among these, although Israel has evidence that there were. 7 were 4 to 7 years old. 9 were 10 to 17. On the Palestinian side, there were 5,791 killed. 2,360 were children, 1,219 were women, 1,500 Al-Qassam fighters crossed the border. The Al-Qassam brigades, by the way, are the Hamas combat units. There are 5,300 Palestinian prisoners in Israel. Once before, Israel released over 1,000 prisoners in exchange for 2 Israeli bodies, so perhaps there is some room for negotiations. There's a lot of personal misery out there. When Biden was asked about the high number of fatalities reported by the Palestinian Health Department following Israeli air raids, he said he had no notion that the Palestinians are telling the truth. Then he added, "Killing innocents is the price of waging war." The Health Department, not controlled by Hamas, by the way, quickly released a 210-page report listing the names of 7,028 people killed from October 7th to October 26th. The report listed name, age, gender, and ID. There were 2,913 children, 41%, and 3,128 females, 45%. They estimated that there were 1,600 private burials, not in their records. A friend asked me a question. What if the IRA committed a mass atrocity in Belfast? How would the world react if the British responded with massive bombing raids that killed a large number of civilians? I told him it would not be the same. The victims would be white and they would be Catholics. When I heard that Biden had promised Netanyahu $100 billion in aid, I said I would like to ask Biden and Netanyahu each a question. For Biden, I would ask, what did you get in exchange for your money? Trump tended to give things away without asking for anything in exchange. Surely you did not ask Bibi for a promise that he would negotiate with the Palestinians when this is over. He can weasel out of that in a minute. And as for Netanyahu, I would ask, you knew that this day was coming. What did you think you would do on this day? And you know that tomorrow is coming, don't you? What will you do then? The global temperature as a result of this war has gone up exponentially. And to those in Israel and the West, they were caught completely off guard. The American National Security Advisor said not long ago that the region is quieter than it has ever been in the past 2 years. Dream on. It is always there, just below the surface. The struggle is not just a local issue. Much of the global South, as it is called, feels that this is also their struggle. There are rallies across the globe, many inside of NATO countries, that have emerged as Israel's strongest supporters: Britain, France, Germany, Italy. Our own domestic political system has also been shaken. Both Jews and Arabs, including Muslims, have been traumatized by what happened and is still happening. And I might add, what is about to happen. Jews are looking for their allies to support them and are generally receiving that support. Arabs and Muslims are distressed by the one-sided pro-Israeli statements coming out of our leadership. I think the tensions we're seeing today will become stronger and more intense in the future, and we will have serious implications for the 2024 presidential election. I'm very worried about vigilante attacks on individual Jews and Muslims. Both communities have reported a spike in attacks and threats of various kinds. There is quite a bit of internet hostility. The White House had made a very strong statement about how they will not tolerate this and have a task force to monitor and address the danger. Interestingly, they appear to be treating the Jewish and Arab Muslim issues separately. My impression is that the Jewish side is getting more attention. The Anti-Defamation League, the major Jewish protection organization in the country, is moving very strongly. But based on the interviews I have seen with their leaders, they seem to be more concerned about words than actions, although perhaps they think words are the precursors of actions. According to them, there have been 400 rallies around the country, many on campuses, in support of the October 7th killings. To be honest, I doubt that. There's a tendency among people with an enemy mindset to assume that all of their opponents or critics harbor the most malevolent thoughts or motives, and therefore it is reasonable to accuse them of having or expressing those malevolent thoughts. I've been out of the country for 2 weeks and have only attended one event in London, but no one was praising murder. They were criticizing the Israeli occupation and calling for protection of vulnerable Palestinians. To be sure, many people consider those October 7th attacks a predictable consequence of the occupation policies. To Israeli supporters, that sounds like blaming Israel, as they would say. And there's an exceptional level of anti-Israeli sentiment out there, and anti-Jewish sentiment, given that there are people who see these two groups as overlapping. It frightens me, to be honest. Still, while we never know what is in someone's heart, I would see these protests as confronting a political situation rather than being classical anti-Semitism, that is, hating Jews because they are Jews, or seeing them as inherently evil. And to be honest, I have seen some statements, not a majority to be sure, which parallel that mindset, suggesting that this is just what Jews do. But that's not the pattern. The ADL is also saying that instructors are inculcating their students with anti-Israeli thinking. They're calling for universities to close down certain Palestinian support groups. They're particularly hostile to Students for Justice in Palestine, which has been banned in Florida and restricted elsewhere. They want university presidents to make sure that their anti-discrimination programs, DEI in academic terminology, are implemented in such a way as to protect Jews and Israelis, not to constrain them. And they want them to issue strong statements against what they call hate, which to me as a former faculty ombudsman is a vague term, hard to define. I don't want to sound as if I'm belittling the efforts of the ADL. The threat is real. But some statements seem more argumentative and less focused upon the real dangers. Let me conclude with two observations, one about the media you're receiving and one about the 2024 election. There was a study in the 1990s of pundits, mostly television discussants and newspaper editorialists, if you remember newspapers, people who report on or comment on Israeli-Arab issues. On cable news today, it's often hard to tell the difference between news and opinion, to be honest. The researcher came up with 70-some names, which he broke down in terms of their perspectives. He found that 61 were reflexively pro-Israeli, that is, right-wing and pro-Likud. Interestingly, those people tended to be right-wing on almost every other issue as well. Six of the people in the study are critical supporters of Israel. Tom Friedman would be one. They would often criticize Israeli policy on the grounds that it was not in Israel's interest to pursue such policies. As I like to say, they were criticizing from within the circle. The third group was the smallest, five people. They were considered consistently critical of Israel. Patrick Buchanan was one of those. None of these critics were full-time on any network. Of course, today the names would be different, but I don't think the patterns have changed. There are a few Muslim or progressive reporters who slip in different perspectives from time to time, but CNN is running its programs as Israel at war. It is as if we ourselves are at war, which in a sense we are. It reminds me of what happened after September 11th, when the permanent headline on CNN was "America Strikes Back." And even the BBC, after a week of resistance, has been forced to use the word terrorist anytime it mentions Hamas. The person who did that pundit study reached a conclusion that got my attention. He said there are two narratives on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The first is that Israel is a small, struggling democracy under siege from implacable enemies who want to destroy it. The second is that Israel is a colonial state and has conquered Palestinian territory and is suppressing the Palestinian people. They are fighting back, which they are allowed to do under international law. So far, that did not surprise me. I knew both of those narratives, and even written on them. My podcast, Three Narratives on Israel, summarizes those perspectives. But here is the point that really surprised me. The researcher said that Americans hear the first narrative, but the rest of the world hears the second. Ouch! That means we cannot really understand what the rest of the world, especially the global South, is even thinking and what motivates them. I want you to think of that 70-something Israeli female captive who was released by Hamas. She delivered two statements that were very different from each other. One had to do with what happened when she was captured. She said it was hell and told about being hit with a stick. The second statement was that she and the other captives were treated very kindly. Their needs were carefully met. A doctor came by to see them every few days. When she was released, she turned around and shook hands with a Hamas soldier who had delivered her to the Red Cross. Both of these stories are true, and yet some news reports emphasize the first, the hell part. Others emphasize the second, the kindness, and the handshake with the word shalom as she left. Warning, do not be a passive consumer of the news. Think, analyze, and seek different media outlets. Let me share an insight that may upset you. Well, if you're a Trump supporter, this observation will make you happy. But if you're hoping Biden gets reelected in 2024, it may not. It comes from Michigan, where I live. In 2016, Trump carried this traditionally blue state by a small margin. Turnout among Democrats was very low, and among Republicans was high. In 2020, turnout was high overall, and the state flipped back to the Democratic column. Recently, our governor, a Democrat, who has been very friendly to Arabs and Muslims, went to a pro-Israeli rally and delivered a very passionate speech. She emphasized Israel's right to defend itself, an Israeli war slogan in conflict after conflict. She made no reference whatsoever, there or elsewhere, about the fact that thousands of innocent Palestinians were dying and were about to die. The reaction in the Arab and Muslim community was intense. Many people said they had supported her before but would never do so again, and that Biden, who used similar rhetoric, would never get their vote. And I should note that sympathy for Palestinians is not restricted to Arabs or Muslims. Overall, this is a generational pattern. Ask if they sympathize more with Israel or Palestine. There's a 46% advantage for Israel among boomers and among Gen X, the older generations. But among millennials, the pattern shifts. 42% sympathize more with Palestinians, 40% more with Israelis. By party, we might note Democrats sympathize with the Palestinians by 49% to 38%, Republicans with the Israelis by 78% to 11%. This is a dramatic shift. It was not long ago that Israel was a nonpartisan issue. That was before Netanyahu went to war against Obama and the Republican leadership marched along with him. But American demographics and our generations are changing dramatically, and our views of this conflict are changing with them. But what will those disgruntled Democrats do? They really have two choices: throw away their vote on a symbolic third party or stay at home. Most Biden voters are not likely to shift to Trump, who is definitely not their friend. Regardless, I suspect that the turnout in 2024, at least on the Democratic side, may be significantly down. And I suspect turnout on the Republican side will be strong. That means Trump could easily carry this pivotal state. And without Michigan, I'm not sure how Biden or any Democrat can win re-election. Keep thinking about that, and be sure to seek out international news sources on the internet. As a final thought, I want to mention something that is not necessarily obvious from the outside. The Israeli military, not to mention the political echelon, has suffered a serious setback, even a humiliation. This is the mighty Israeli military, the military that has nuclear weapons and the most sophisticated weaponry in the American arsenal. They were totally unprepared for what happened. They had convinced themselves that their walls and their technology and their security systems were invincible, and that their army was the best in the world. When Hamas broke through the security fences at 15 different points, it was nothing they could have imagined. It was a bit like September 11th. How could someone attack us from within? It is not even clear that Bush read the security memo telling him that Al-Qaeda cells were in the country and were planning to hijack planes. And even if he read it, he did not call an emergency meeting of the National Security Council, which any other president would have done. Likewise, the Israelis were asleep at the wheel. They were captive to their own arrogance and sense of superiority. Think about the tasks of the IDF over the past 2 decades. In 2000, they were driven out of Lebanon by Hezbollah. It was a definite defeat. Everyone acknowledges that. Then in 2006, they went back into Lebanon and once again got seriously bloodied. Everyone also acknowledges that. They have engaged in several clashes with Hamas, but mostly they dealt with those issues by aerial bombardments that killed large numbers of Palestinians and left much devastation behind. Israel was largely untouched. For the past decade and a half, they have mostly dealt with teenage boys throwing rocks or trying to stab people with knives. To be honest, violent settlers have caused them as much trouble as Palestinians. Meanwhile, Hezbollah is a battle-hardened enemy in the north with combat experience in Syria. And Hamas is a powerful organized enemy in the south. They put so much trust in their technological superiority that this attack caught them completely off guard. And it was definitely low tech. And Netanyahu's cabinet was mostly focused on outmaneuvering their domestic opponents, weakening the Supreme Court, keeping him out of jail, furthering the settlements, and ultimately annexing big chunks of the West Bank. There is no one, who thinks Netanyahu has the slightest idea of what he will do once he conquers Gaza. When Colin Powell heard a proposal to send the U.S. Army into Yugoslavia to protect Muslims, he said, "We could do that, but I have three questions. What is the mission? How do we define victory? And how do we get out?" Those are good questions, even essential questions. No one could answer them then, and no one can answer them now. Netanyahu promises to completely destroy Hamas so that it can never arise again. But that is not how history works, especially when there is a resistance movement rooted in a population. A popular resistance movement cannot be eliminated by military means. It can be set back, but it cannot be erased. Of course Hamas will rise again. It may have a different name and different leaders, but it will not disappear. And if you are an Israeli, this trauma is now a permanent part of your life, not just your psyche, but your life, and of the lives of your children and your grandchildren. What will happen next will be a horrendous battle. Urban warfare is brutal and nasty, but not short. The Israelis will have to get out of their tanks and go house to house looking for Hamas soldiers. They are going to take significant casualties. And Palestinian fatalities will be in the thousands, most being non-combatants, women and children. I suspect that God is weeping. Thank you for listening.